It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegebright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
So the Supreme Court heard the cases this spring, and then this past June 26th, they ruled that it should be the law of the land that gay and lesbian people now can marry the person they love.
James Parrish, Executive Director of Equality Virginia, explains the impact of last month's U.S. Supreme Court decision upholding marriage equality in all 50 states, and the continuing efforts to limit that decision. And during this week's News You Can Use, we describe major new rules targeting segregation across the U.S. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 271, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. When the Fair Housing Act was passed in 1968, it barred the outright racial discrimination that was then routine. It also required the government to go one step further, to actively dismantle segregation and foster integration in its place, a mandate that for decades has been largely forgotten, neglected, and unenforced. Last week, the Obama administration announced long-awaited rules designed to repair the law's unfulfilled promise and promote the kind of racially integrated neighborhoods that have long eluded deeply segregated cities. The new rules, a top demand of civil rights groups, will require cities and towns all over the country to scrutinize their housing patterns for racial bias and to publicly report, every 3 to 5 years, the results. Communities will also have to set goals, which will be tracked over time, for how they will further reduce segregation. Officials insist they want to work with and not punish communities where segregation exists, but the new reports will make it harder to conceal when communities consistently flout the law. And in the most flagrant cases, HUD holds out the possibility of withholding a portion of the billions of dollars of federal funding it hands out each year. The new rules already have spurred intense debate. Civil rights groups pushed for even tougher rules, but say HUD's plans represent an important advancement. But conservatives already are trying to defund implementation of the rule, claiming it is government intrusion into local planning and an experiment in social engineering, in which the federal government will force white suburbs to change their racial makeup. The centerpiece of the new rule is a vast trove of geographic data covering every community in the country, its racial makeup, its poverty rate, its concentration of housing vouchers and public housing, as well as the quality of its schools and its public transit. Nearly all of this data comes from publicly available sources like the census. But HUD hopes the database will enable communities to more clearly track where poverty and segregation overlap, where housing voucher recipients live relative to good schools, which neighborhoods contain no affordable housing at all. The premise of the rule is that all of this mapped data will make hidden barriers visible, and that once communities see them, they will be much harder to ignore. The new rule comes less than 2 weeks after the Supreme Court reaffirmed the power of the Fair Housing Act to ban housing policies that harm minorities. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegebright. Turn me around, turn me around, ain't gonna let me. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the headquarters of Equality Virginia. We're speaking with the Executive Director, James Parrish, and we will be talking about last month's marriage equality decision from the United States Supreme Court and what it means for the future and what attacks might be waged against it, even though it is now the law of the land. Welcome back to the show, James.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's wonderful to have you here, and I thought it would be good to start with some background for our listeners, and tell us the history of the struggle for marriage equality in the United States and also in Virginia.
In the United States, this began well over a decade ago when there was a movement for marriage equality in Hawaii, which was then followed up by the work done in Massachusetts, where that was the first place, the first state that actually granted the freedom to marry to gay and lesbian people. The backlash to that quickly became the constitutional amendments across the country, including Virginia in 2006, which passed its anti-marriage amendment. And then we flash forward to 2013 when we had the DOMA ruling, and the ruling by the Supreme Court that the federal government had to recognize marriages performed, even though those people weren't in states that recognized their marriage, really set forward the work on the federal court cases, which we've seen in the past year, and overwhelmingly dozens and dozens and dozens of federal judges quickly were saying that in light of that DOMA ruling and other rulings, that it was a constitutional question of equality and fairness and due process. And so we had two different cases filed here in Virginia in the summer of 2013, and they ended up being combined, and those four plaintiff couples were part of what we call the Bostick case. And then in the February of 2014, a judge, Brenda Wright, in Norfolk ruled that gay and lesbian people did have the constitutional right to marry in Virginia. That was appealed to the 4th District Court. And then in the summer of 2014, the 4th District Court also confirmed that gay and lesbian Virginians have the constitutional right to marry and that our marriage amendment was unconstitutional. And then the Supreme Court refused to hear that case and sent it back down in October 6th of 2014, which is when we then had the freedom to marry here in Virginia.
And yet that, of course, was not the end of the story, because despite the pretty much unbroken string of U.S. District Court cases and U.S. Court of Appeals cases that upheld the right to marry and held it to be a constitutional right, there was at least one or two U.S. circuit courts that disagreed. So how did this case end up in the U.S. Supreme Court, the one that held marriage equality across the land?
Post-DOMA, we had many court rulings across the nation, including those here in Virginia, that affirmed the freedom to marry. But last fall, we did have a couple of cases that came out and where that was not a consistent ruling. The Supreme Court agreed to hear those over the winter, and they heard them this spring. And those were two cases. I think actually they combined four cases. But at that issue was a fundamental case of Obergefell, whose partner had died, and he wanted their marriage to be recognized for the benefits and the responsibilities that come with marriage. And so the Supreme Court heard the cases this spring, and then this past June 26th, they ruled that it should be the law of the land that gay and lesbian people now can marry the person they love.
And so what was the court's reasoning behind this? Was this some right that flowed from being a gay or lesbian person, or was it a right that flowed from being married, or the right to have a marriage?
Definitely seems to have moved most people, including the judges, is that marriage is an ingrained institution not only in our society but in our government. And to deny a loving lesbian or gay couple that to participate in that piece of society was fundamentally unconstitutional, and that you weren't giving due process or equality. I think the judges looked at many things, including the family structure, children. You can see in a lot of the opinions that the federal judges have issued over the past year cite the detrimental effect that denying marriage to a gay and lesbian couple has on their family, has on the children. Time and time again, I've seen federal judges say, you've shown me that the children raised in these unions are discriminated against for no reason other than their parents are of the same gender instead of opposite gender. And I think that was a driving piece of that.
Now, you mentioned in one of your responses that marriage was an ingrained institution. Of course, one of the criticisms that's been raised by conservatives and traditionalists opposed to this is that the court was changing the definition of marriage and changing an ingrained part of society. What was the court's response to that?
Our government structure is built around couples being married from any type of economic benefits, rights and responsibilities, Social Security, death, estates, is all built around that structure. And that itself is outside of the religious piece of what marriage is. And that's what the courts have looked at, is that, you know, structurally as a country, we have built our societies and our laws around this institution of marriage. And I think anyone who takes a step back and looks at the quote-unquote institution of marriage would see that it is something that has changed continuously for not just the past several generations in America, but over the past centuries. You know, how we look at what marriage means between a man and woman 1,000 years ago in England is a lot different than what I think most of us would consider marriages today.
Right. Well, certainly a marriage several 100 years ago in England, or for that matter in this country, the woman was considered the property of the husband.
Right. And I think most women would take issue with that definition of marriage today. And so, you know, as I said the other day when I was speaking with some people who were saying that it was destroying the institution of marriage, they were at the same time citing like that the number of people in America who are getting married continues to go down. The divorce rate, you know, remains steady and high. And, you know, my point on that has always been, I think if you look at these thousands and thousands of loving gay and lesbian couples and the as hard as they have worked and as tirelessly as they've worked and fight to participate in this institution should be seen as something to strengthen marriage and show that, you know, how much they do value it. You know, no one has gotten into this work and struggled for a decade to bring the freedom to marry to Virginia to tear down an institution. You know, they want to be part of that institution. They celebrate it. And I think that's a piece that a lot of people don't quite see.
And I think there were probably no better words to describe that than the final paragraph of Justice Kennedy's majority opinion, the 5-4 majority opinion, which said as follows: "No union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. In forming a marital union, two people become something greater than once they were. As some of the petitioners in these cases demonstrate, marriage embodies a love that may endure even past death. It would misunderstand these men and women to say they disrespect the idea of marriage. Their plea is that they do respect it so deeply that they seek to find its fulfillment for themselves. Their hope is not to be condemned to live in loneliness, excluded from one of civilization's oldest institutions. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right." And in light of what Justice Kennedy said, and you mentioned earlier that this gives gay and lesbian couples both the rights and responsibilities of marriage. So how does this change for gay and lesbian couples? What are those rights? What are all those responsibilities?
We've seen this over the years of the work we do. It's just alarming when you get into this work, to see how, as I said, intertwined our society is with this institution of marriage. You know, we've had membership who had cancer and had to stop their job, and they were self-employed and lost their health insurance but couldn't get on their partner's health insurance because their marriage wasn't recognized. You have parents raising kids together, but where only one is the legal parent. That can set up the situation where if the breadwinner is not the legal parent of the child and the legal parent was the stay-at-home mom or stay-at-home dad and something happened to that parent, that the other parent who wasn't legal but the breadwinner of the family, the child doesn't get the Social Security benefits. We have also estates, you know, when someone dies, if not leaving. You have the Medicaid, Medicare, Impoverishment Act. If you were two gay people living together, if you were married and one of you needs to go to the nursing home, you do not have to sell your house as part of winding your assets down. But that didn't translate to gay and lesbian couples. And so lots of responsibilities and rights go in there and benefits for marriage, and that is what has become available and equitable to the people that are already participating. You know, most of these couples are people who have been together for years and years, and all this ruling and the freedom to marry does for them is actually give them the economic and structural stability that, you know, other people's relationships were already enjoying.
And so what about things like filing taxes or filing bankruptcy? I guess there's a big change there for gay and lesbian couples as well.
Right. And, you know, and you also for lots of gay and lesbian couples who don't have kids, you know, and both are working, they are now experiencing what many people call the marriage penalty. So, you know, as not everything automatically transfers into a benefit, but that is part of the responsibility of being a married couple. You live by the laws of the land, and, you know, you pay your taxes and you participate in society.
Right. And another example of not necessarily a benefit is if a couple is getting SSI, Supplemental Security Income benefits, income is deemed from one spouse to another spouse and can reduce the SSI benefits of the disabled spouse. That wasn't happening before marriage equality, and now that there's marriage equality, it does.
Right, and there's many examples of that, of taking an instance where previously you were treated as two independent adults maybe living in the same home, and now you're looking at, you know, the government looks at you as a total family structure, and they should, and, you know, that's just part of the process.
So it's both pluses and minuses for gay and lesbian couples, but clearly the pluses vastly outweigh the minuses. So in view of all of that, and in view of the Supreme Court's decision, you would think it's the settled law of the land, and yet conservatives, traditionalists, particularly on the religious right, don't seem content to accept this and are beginning to think about challenges to it or protections that they believe are needed for protecting religious liberty. What about those possible challenges coming down the pike?
We do have the freedom of religion in this country. This marriage ruling in no way is going to force a religious leader to marry a gay or lesbian couple in their church if they do not want to. Currently, you know, that is up to faith institutions now who they do and do not marry. That does not change. But as one of our former board members, not former, current board members said at our Commonwealth dinner this past spring, we might now be able to say I do, but there's plenty out there who say no, you don't. And I also look at it as it's nothing more than them saying, you know, okay, the state, the government might have to recognize your union or your marriage now, but I don't. And what are all the ways that I can pass laws and regulations so that I don't have to recognize it? And at the end of the day, that's just not going to work. There is religious liberty in this country, but a lot of these religious freedom restoration acts, RFRAs, as they're called, that are being pushing through in the past that we've seen in other states, and what they're talking about doing in Virginia, is nothing more than allowing people to discriminate. When you open your door to your business to the public, you're opening, we firmly believe you're opening that door to everyone, and you do not get to choose who you serve and don't serve. And I think if we really think about it, you're opening the door to a very slippery slope if people are allowed to, based on their own personal convictions and belief, decide who is worthy of their, you know, business service and who isn't. That's just not a society I think most of us want to live in.
Well, let me toss out a related issue and see what your reaction to that is. Of course, abortion has been the law of the land for more than 40 years. It's legal. There are always attempts to try to limit it and restrict it, but, you know, for the most part, it is legal. And yet, some states have enacted what I think are called conscience clauses that says that, well, if you are have a strong religious belief, it's sin to do an abortion, to conduct an abortion, and your job might require you to do that. Let's say you're a nurse in a hospital or something of that nature. Your conscience clause allows you to not do that. Do you see something like that coming down? Do you see something like that being upheld?
I don't see anything like that coming down that I think is worthy of it. If your religion does not accept two men or two women in the union of marriage, you do not have to marry them. You do not have to recognize that union in your church. But you operating a gift shop or a card shop or a restaurant, in no way is that affecting your faith in a way that it's serving that couple their dinner. I think there's a difference in a doctor performing a medical duty against their conscience and what we talk about opening our doors to businesses on the street.
So you would say there's a very big difference between being involved in an abortion procedure and simply baking a cake or serving a dinner or doing a bunch of bouquet flowers or something of that nature.
I think this is more than just what some people say is a religious liberty. I think this is a fundamental. There's some people who do not support gay and transgender people in our society. And I think this is a clear way to say, again, that the state might have to recognize you now, but we do not. And, there's been defiance by some groups for years and years in the General Assembly. Every time there's a pro-LGBT bill that has nothing to do with marriage, we're talking about protecting people from being fired because they're gay or transgender, the Independent Baptist Organization and the Family Foundation are the only organizations that are standing against this, and they're the organizations that will be pushing these RFRAs. And so it's much more than just this argument they're trying to twist of a little old lady having to make a cake for a gay couple. It's about we're finding every way we can to fundamentally not recognize you. That they have been consistent in making sure the words sexual orientation and gender identity don't go into our code because they do not want gay and transgender people to be recognized in the state.
And do you see this marriage equality decision as moving the needle? I mean, certainly the Code of Virginia has to be modified to deal with the marriage equality decision. I mean, already I've seen the vital records form change from husband and wife to, I think it's spouse A and spouse B. And that form is in use now. So do you see the marriage equality decision moving the needle on these other issues and other rights of employment and housing and public accommodations for gay, lesbian, transgender people?
I hope so. I mean, it also is strengthening the resistance of these groups. A lot of people also look at the freedom to marry separate from those issues. The interesting thing is the majority of Virginians and clearly our business community are already light years ahead on this issue. Every major employer in this, as we look out of this office looking at Dominion and other companies, have been recognizing and including sexual orientation and gender identity protections for their employees for years. Thankfully, our governor, current governor McAuliffe, when he came in, did the same for state employees, but that's an executive order and is dependent upon each governor. At the end of the day, I think what helps most from the freedom to marry on that issue is it just continue to change hearts and minds. More people seeing that, oh, the gay couple down the street getting married has not changed my daily routine at all. And, oh, but they didn't even tell their employer that they were going on a honeymoon because they feared they might be fired. And that's a true fear. That is something we deal with. There are people who are getting married, going on their honeymoon, but not telling their employer why they're taking a week's vacation. They're not putting their spouse's picture on their desk for fear of being discriminated against. And in this state, it is currently still legal to fire or not hire, deny housing, or deny service in a business to somebody because they're gay or transgender.
And hopefully that will change over the coming years.
Party one for us.
Well, thank you so much. We have been speaking with James Parrish. He is the Executive Director of Equality Virginia, and we have been talking about the marriage equality decision last month from the United States Supreme Court and the future of marriage equality and other types of equality for lesbian, gay, and transgender people in Virginia. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegebright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Last month, the U.S. Supreme Court also made an important decision about redistricting. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when Claire Gastaniaga, Executive Director of the ACLU of Virginia, explains the problems of redistricting and racial and partisan gerrymandering and the difficult solutions that are needed. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegebright.